from, pronounce me if this is wrong, McLean, Virginia?
Yeah, that's close enough.
Okay. He's also from Virginia and one of our sponsors for one of our colleagues here at Get in the Car. So we're going to have him speak tonight for us, and I'll let him take the show.
Thank you. My name is Matt Berkowitz. I'm an alcoholic. Would you mind turning the, yeah, perfect.
Yep.
Turn the camera. Thank you, Kristen. Matt Berkowitz, alcoholic. I have a sobriety date. It's the 1st of November, 1998. I am actively sponsored in Alcoholics Anonymous and a member of a home group. That home group is We Ought Not Be Organized. It is in McLean, Virginia. I am not from Virginia. I reside in Maryland and dislike Virginia some days. So we don't, Virginians and Marylands, I live on the border. We don't really like crossing the river, but I will cross the river for an AA meeting. I also have the honor and privilege of sponsoring people in Alcoholics Anonymous, including Kristen. And Kristen, I guess I want to thank you for, and whoever else invited me, allowing me to participate in my sobriety. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's an honor and privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, it wasn't an honor and a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted you people to fix me and I can go on my merry way. And I didn't want to be. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been here before. And I also want to thank you for extending the accommodation to allow me to speak online. I had planned to fly in yesterday. I wanted to be in there in person, and my youngest son has had a high fever all week. He's better now, but Chris and I made the joint decision. I guess I really should say my wife made the decision. Actually, to be honest, it was Kristen and I that made the decision, and I think my wife was happy with the decision just to be here. So I do feel, I really do feel bad that I can't be there in person. I've been looking forward to this for a few months now to be able to be in a room with you guys and meet some of you in person, not all of you, but some of you in person. And it's been an honor and privilege to work with Kristen, I guess, for a little more than maybe coming up on 9 years, 8 and a half, 9 years at this point. I was just thinking about it. It's been a long time. And I've known Kristen since she got sober. And then the plan really was never for me to sponsor Kristen. I you know she was struggling, and maybe I don't remember too much of the conversation. I just know we talk, and I know she was struggling. I know she was having some issues with her sponsor, and she had asked me to sponsor her, and I said, "No, you need to talk to your fir sponsor first." And gets off the phone with me, calls back 10 seconds later, and says, "I fired my sponsor." I said, "I gave you one direction. You couldn't even follow that." And she said, "No, you just told me to talk to my sponsor." I did, and I fired her. That was Kristen at 16 months of sobriety, a little defiant, a little obstinate. She has done everything I've asked her to do over the last 8 and a half, more than 8 and a half years, and it has become. She's like a daughter to me, a sister. I mean, I'm not that old. Daughter, sister, whatever you want to call it. And I've had the joy and privilege to watch her grow into a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had the privilege of watching other people I sponsor grow into adults and fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that's honestly, that's the greatest for a selfish guy like me. That's like the greatest gift is to watch someone's delight in someone's eyes come on, and then go from there to grow in basically from an emotional child or to an adult and fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous and then begin to give back. And I want to thank this group for taking Kristen in, and I suppose John as well. But I, you know, making her feel at welcome and making sure that AA is there for when she moved. And I don't know. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's where you are. You're in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to welcome you, and I hope that you find what most of us have found. And at least for me, it's a way to go a day at a time, be able to go to bed at night without putting any alcohol or mood altering substance in me, and to live peacefully and live comfortably in my own skin. And I truly believe that's available for everybody. And if you're new, I suggest you grab a sponsor and grab a big book and start on the path, or not. Anyway, my job's to tell you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I often hear that phrase misquoted. You know, people say, you know, tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Not what the book says, because here's the problem. It has been the same. What it was like sucked. People sucked. What it's like, what happened, and what it's like now, people still suck, right? What's changed is me. I was like something happened, and I don't know how I'm supposed to tell you what I'm like now. And the only thing that's changed over the last, you know, 24 and a half years is me and my reactions to life. The world hasn't changed. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a design for living to deal with the world, because I don't like the world. That's just my natural state. My first drink, I was 8 days old, technically. I grew up in the Jewish religion, and they have a little ceremony at 8 days old called a snipping clip, also known as a bris. And they give, as part of the ceremony, to dull the pain. To give the baby wine to drink. And technically that was my first drink. I don't remember it. So I guess that was my first blackout. And it certainly was my first resentment. And I am a blackout drinker, and I am a person still today that can pick up a resentment on a dime because I'm justified in whatever I believe. And now, obviously, I didn't run off to the races thereafter and become a daily drinker or anything like that. But I've always been fascinated with alcohol. Always been fascinated. I, you know, just remember being, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old and being at restaurants with my parents and whatever, and, you know, they would be like restaurants where there's a bar there, right? And I just remember not being interested in whatever was going on at the family table, but I was interested in what was behind me at the bar. Like, it seemed like at the bar something was going on. I would just turn my chair and just stare at the bottles, and it was as if I could hear the ice melting. I've just always been fascinated with alcohol. I remember earliest memories. I remember my father drinking a Michelob. I have no idea why. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that's just, maybe to an alcoholic, that's, you know, obviously it makes sense, but like, I don't remember my father having a Diet Coke. You know what I'm saying? Like, I, of all of these memories and different things, why does my father drinking a Michelob stand out? And I've just always had this fascination with alcohol. And I came from a good family. You know, middle upper class, New Jersey, not, you know, nothing outwardly wrong. I mean, my family's crazy, but, you know, there's nothing I could point to say, this is why I'm alcoholic. But my earliest memories are just what the book describes as feeling restless, irritable, and discontented. And I'm talking at like 3 and 4 years old, feeling restless, irritable, discontented, full of shame, guilt, remorse, any negative emotion. I just was wrapped so tight. And these are my earliest memories. And again, no reason I should feel fear this way. There wasn't like you know, physical abuse or anything that I should be scared of going on in the house, and but just so wrapped, excuse me, around the axle. And I remember, you know, in like kindergarten, first and second grade, being dropped off and like crying, not wanting to go inside. I mean, I just always felt like I was on the outside, and I had some behavioral issues. You know, I was kicked out of, it's hard to keep track what I was been kicked out of. I was kicked out of nursery school. Then I had to stay back in kindergarten, literally because I couldn't play with, well with others in the sandbox. And I, around that age, I began to have like violent outbursts, where I would hit my mother, you know, kick holes in the wall, throw dishes, just antisocial behavior. Because I just remember just feeling so restless, irritable, and discontented that I just didn't know what to do with it. And I just didn't know how to react to life on life's terms. And I mean, I remember I was in kindergarten, mind you, now it's the second time I've had this teacher before. I know where the toys are, but it seems like all the other kids know where the toys are before I do. And it seems as though, you know, the teacher said, okay, kids, tomorrow everybody wear blue. And then I come in the next day, I'm the only kid wearing red. It seems like all the other kids have the rule book to life and I don't have it. And that's just how I felt as a kid. That doesn't make me alcoholic. It maybe makes me weird or some other stuff. It doesn't make me alcoholic, but I think it set something in motion. I think that's the part of the spiritual malady of alcoholism. And for me anyway, and I'm having these violent outbursts and these weird reactions or abnormal reactions to life circumstances. And I'm being taken to psychologists and psychiatrists and well-meaning doctors, you know what I'm saying? Like well-meaning people. And my parents love me and they're, you know, don't know what to do. It wasn't like they don't know what to do with me, like, but it was more like they're trying to help me. And I'm going to these doctors and psychologists and psychiatrists and I'm getting all these diagnoses, acronyms. They're all acronyms, you know, ADD, ADHD, ODD, OCD, PTSD, not post-traumatic stress syndrome, pre-traumatic stress syndrome. I know someone's going to screw me anytime now. And I'm getting all these diagnoses, and this is just, you know, me and my opinion based on my experience. For me, this is my experience. I probably do have these things. I mean, ask Kristen, she's the psychologist here. She's the professional. And I know she's diagnosed me with a bunch of stuff in her mind. But like, if I truly had psychological problems and only psychological and emotional issues, the amount of therapy I had would have cured me. The problem is I believe all of that stuff is largely the spiritual malady of alcoholism. I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. And when I go to therapy, guess what? We get to talk about my favorite subject, me, and how everybody's screwing me. And it's just feeding it. And if really psychological problems were just my problem, then I would have been fine from it. But over the year, over those next several years, I would only become worse because I didn't have the solution that would fix me. And that solution would become alcohol. And again, you know, there are plenty of people who have weird stuff, right? And I may have that weird stuff too. But the thing with me is alcohol cures that. Alcohol doesn't cure that for everybody. And I remember being about 11 or 12 years old, and I had taken sips off my father's beer, or whatever. And like I said, I was always fascinated with alcohol, but you know, I had thrown another temper tantrum and my parents had had enough and they left me home alone. And I instinctively knew to hit the liquor cabinet, instinctively. And there was dust all over it. You know, my father, I've never seen have more than two drinks. And by this time, my mother had quit drinking. She's probably what the big book describes as a problem drinker. You know, outward appearances, she probably looks like an alcoholic when she drank. She would start drinking, and my father would come home and find her, you know, passed out on the floor with the empty box of wine on top of her. But the doctors, you know, for health reasons, she was told she needed to stop drinking, and she was able to just never went to AA, just put the plug in the jug and was fine. And she's not had a drink in 40 some years. She likes pills, but she hasn't had a drink in 40 some years. And sadly, that pill problem has become a problem. So they're gone, and I instinctively knew to hit this liquor cabinet, and I'm looking through the bottles, and I grabbed the bottle of Wild Turkey, and I remember I picked the Wild Turkey because it had a little cartoon character of a turkey on it, and I took a plug, and it burned going down. And then it burned coming back up, and then it started to settle down, and I began to feel this warmth, just this warmth all over me that was in my hair that I did have at the time. I could feel it on the tip of my ears, and it was absolutely like magic. All that restlessness, that irritability, that discontentedness that I had, the fear, anxiety, guilt, remorse, shame, all of that began to dissipate. And I finally felt like the first time in my life, I felt like I could breathe. I finally felt comfortable in my own skin. And I finally felt the way the other kids at school look. And that's what alcohol does for me. And if you know what I'm talking about, maybe you're alcoholic. I don't know. But if you have no idea what I'm talking about, you're probably not alcoholic. I don't know. I'm not going to diagnose, but I describe that to non-alcoholic people, like my wife, and they're like, "What the hell are you talking about?" Alcohol does something for me that it does not do for 90-some% of the population. It makes me feel okay. It may take a weird, scared, violent, angry kid and makes him feel like he fits in this world. And I instantly knew I wanted to drink whenever I could drink. That was it. And I would, from that day on, I would find excuses to stay home and hit that liquor cabinet. I would find friends that were allowed to drink at home. I would steal alcohol. But I have an image, right? Like, I didn't like go run out and join the burnouts at school because I want to look good. I want to look good to my parents. I am so selfish and self-centered. And I used to think selfishness is like, you had to be like bad or evil. And I did bad things, and don't get me wrong, but like, I didn't think I could be selfish because I really wasn't like me. I'm not intentionally mean to people. I'm like, I'm not selfish. Like, I'm the type of person that, you know, if there's one soda left in the fridge, I'll leave that for my wife, right? I'm not selfish. Yeah, I am. Here's the deal, because I will leave that one soda in the fridge for my wife, but then I'm going to tell her 15 times that I left it for her, because I'm expecting something in return. That's me at the core, that I'm always, not that I'm bad because I'm selfish. I'm just constantly thinking about me and what you're thinking about me. That's it. I spend my 90% of my day is thinking about what you're thinking about me. When I am introduced to people, I'm terrible at remembering names. It's not that I don't have a bad memory. I might, but it's not that I have a bad memory. It's that when I introduce myself and say, "Hey, I'm Matt, nice to meet you," and Kristen then introduces herself to me with her name, I'm too busy thinking what I'm going to say next so I don't look stupid to Kristen that I don't catch her name. That I'm constantly stuck worrying about me. And the other thing is, it took me a number of years to realize this. But at the core of this, like, I was probably 12 years sober before I realized, really what I want, really my problem. I just want to be recognized for my greatness without doing a goddamn thing. I just want to walk into a room and say, "There he goes. Can I get you this? Can I get you that? Here's the right carpet." That's just how I'm, that's selfish. That's selfish and self-centered. And I don't know where I was going with that. because I was thinking about me again. But I just desperately want to be liked. I just desperately want acceptance. And that riddles me with fear to the point that I become restless and restless, irritable, and discontented until I drink. And when I drink, I don't care as much. And so I spent these high school years because, you know, high school is not easy. And, you know, but I want to look good. I want to look good to the teachers. I want to look good to my family. So I towed the line where I'm not running with bad kids. I'm really careful to stay out of trouble. And I really had no consequences for my drinking. You know, I would stay at friends' houses and sleep over and we'd drink and whatever. And that'd be fine. I did it on the weekends. And during the week, I would sneak. I mean, this is what my drinking looked like as a teenager, primarily. I would somehow accumulate a bottle of vodka or a couple of bottles of wine. I would hide them in my closet. I'd wait for my parents to go to sleep. And then I would play video games and take shots off the bottle and smoke Marlboro menthols out the window. That's what I was doing at 13, 14 years old, thinking there's nothing wrong with what I'm doing. That I'm thinking that's normal living. I'm thinking all kids are doing it. But at this point in 14 and 15 years old, I need to do this in order to sleep at night, in order to shut the noise off in my head, because alcohol is my solution. And what's amazing is the more I would drink, because I would go through periods, right? Like I would drink every day for several months and then I wouldn't drink for a couple of months, whatever. I mean, access to alcohol is, you know, it is what it is. And the more regularly I drank, the strangest thing would happen. The doctors and my mother would get together and say, I don't know what's going on, but he's doing great. He doesn't need to come see me anymore. Mm-hmm. The more I drink, the better I'm actually getting and behaving. And doctors don't need to see me. Alcohol, I have tangential proof that alcohol is a solution. I drink, doctors go away. I drink, I don't need medication. And then I go through these periods where I'm not drinking, I'm, you know, dry. And I get to make visits to the psych ward. This, you know, alcohol is my solution. In any event, I go through high school. I do okay, I guess, you know, and by the time I'm a senior, I've got these accomplishments, right? And I'm, you know, I'm senior class president. You know, I'm first team All-State in baseball in New Jersey. I've got a girlfriend. I don't like her, but I've got a girlfriend. I got a host of friends. I don't like them. I'm in this club, I'm on that club, I've got this award, I've got that. And on paper, right, if I got a resume now going to college, on paper, I should be the happiest kid in the world. I've got all these marks, right? Yet I'm dying inside because that's how I live. I believe that once I get that accolade, I'll be fine. Once I get her, I'll be fine. Once I get that job, I'll be fine. Once I get that amount of money, I'll be fine. Once I get that raise, I'll be fine. Once I'm there, I'll be fine. Once I get out of the house, I still live to this day today. Like once I'm wherever, I'll be fine. And the problem is I'm using external things to fill a God-sized hole, that spiritual malady. And the only thing that has ever, because here's what happens, like, right? Like I think once I get that amount of money, I'll be fine. I'll get that amount of money and now it's not enough. And I'll get that girl and I don't want that girl. I want that girl, right? It doesn't matter what I get. The award, the accolade, the win is short-lived. It cures that restlessness, irritability, and discontentedness temporarily. And what I'm doing is I'm trying to use external things to fill a God-sized hole. And the only thing in my experience that has filled that hole has been booze and God. And booze worked. Booze filled it up and lasted a lot longer than an A. You know, I get an A in a class and I'm happy for a day. And now the fear sets in that I'll never be able to get that A again. You know, I'll have a baseball game and I'll go 4 for 4. And now and I'm thrilled that night. And now I can't sleep that night when I go to bed because I'm fearful that I'm a fraud and I got lucky and it's not going to happen again. Or I'll get that girl and I can't enjoy the relationship because I'm tormented that she's going to break up with me at any moment. And I need to drink. And drinking makes me feel okay. And fast forward, I get to college. By the time I'm 18 years old, I'm a daily drinker. I didn't plan it that way. I just am a daily drinker and I'm beginning to have consequences for my drinking. And within a couple of months, the girlfriend is pissed off at me for my drinking. The girl I'm cheating on her with is pissed off for my drinking. I'm on academic probation. I'm kicked off the baseball team. I've been hospitalized a couple of times for excessive drinking. I'm kicked out of a fraternity for drinking, which is, I guess, hard to do. It wasn't the drinking that was the problem. It's that they don't like you. You're not supposed to punch the pledge master. It doesn't matter. I'm starting to have violent behavior. Cops are showing up. I'm beginning to have consequences from my drinking. And I wind up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember sitting there, this is nice for you, but I've got deep, complex emotional problems that you can't help with. That, you know, you talked about two things that just I wasn't going to do. The first thing was God, right? You're talking about finding God. Nope, there is no God. I don't believe in God. That's fine if you want to believe in God, but I don't. God's for, you know, simple-minded people. And I've got these deep emotional complex problems that certainly need more than, need more than putting a dollar in the basket to solve. And the other thing you suggest is to quit drinking altogether, which I was not interested in. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. At the time, I did know it, to control and enjoy my drinking. I wanted to be able to drink like everybody else drank, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, maybe Sundays. I wanted to stop drinking on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesdays. That was it. And I wanted to stop winding up in the hospital. I wanted to stop getting alcohol poisoning. And I lasted, I don't know, 30 days. I mean, over the next couple of years, when the heat was on, I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I would realize that was a stupid decision because you guys are lame. I don't like you guys. I mean, what do you guys do? Bowl? I mean, I don't like bowling. I'm 18, 19 years old. I need to drink. There's a lot of drinking left to do. And I realized, you know what? I'm not alcoholic, because I would come to AA and I would hear things like, I would hear stupid things like, you know, just quit drinking. You'll be happy. Well, just don't drink. Well, if I could not drink, why do I need your stupid meetings? I would hear, well, whoever got up earliest this morning has been sober the longest. That's stupid. Does that mean that, like, if I take a nap, is that a relapse? I would just hear the stupidest things and just sit in the rooms and just absolutely judge the hell out of everything, you know? And then I would get confused about things. And I'm not alcoholic. It seemed like everybody who came to AA would quit drinking and they would win the lottery, right? And their life's got wonderful. And I come to AA, I've quit drinking, and I've never thought about suicide more in my life. I've never thought about homicide more in my life. I'm getting, my life is getting darker and darker sober. I guess I'm not alcoholic. I wish I were alcoholic, because I get rich like you people, but I just can't do it. You know what? I'm not alcoholic. My problem is just the consequences. I just need to control and enjoy my consequences. The problem, I got kicked off the baseball team, not because of my drinking, because the coach is an ass. So I learned to now defend and justify my drinking and develop resentments to do that. The girlfriend, well, she can go. She's gone. She doesn't like the way I drink. She's gone. I'll find somebody who let me drink the way I want to drink. You know, classes, academic probation. I got to just change my major. Change the time I'm taking my classes. I'm just going to start changing everything around me to way I can, so that I can drink the way I want to drink. And I remember going to college with these goals, dreams, and aspirations, right? And yet, over a few short months, I'm lowering my standards, goals, dreams, and aspirations so I can drink the way I want to drink. I mean, I had graduated college, sort of, and I had a job lined up, and I had problems going to work. And I'm like, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. I'm going to quit my job. And I got a job bartending. It was a job well above my qualifications. And, you know, I had plans to go to law school and this and that. And I'm like, nope, I'd rather drink and just bartend. And I lower my expectations and I develop resentments and I'm going to change my life to justify and defend the way I want to drink. And I begin to have strained relationships with my family. You know, and I began to do some shitty stuff, some crummy stuff. Trying to think which story to tell first. I mean, I barely spoke to my parents at this point. I had no relationship with my brother. I'm in and out of hospitals, both for physical stuff and mental stuff. And at some point, my parents moved from New Jersey to Florida and didn't tell me. I mean, and I go home to New Jersey and they don't live there anymore. My mother says she told me. She may have told me, and I may have been in a blackout, but like that's where I was. You know, my parents, they came down for my graduation. And I remember, you know, this is in DC, and I remember walking from, you know, they're meeting me at the graduation ceremony was like near the White House on what's called the Ellipse or something like that. And I remember walking there and I stopped at TGI Fridays on the way just to have one shot of tequila, just to have one shot. And I never made it to my graduation. That's who I become. I take a drink, all bets are off. At some point, my grandmother had passed away. And it took me a couple days to get back from DC to New York and New Jersey. Because I stopped the drink. And when I got back, I went ahead and I liquidated my grandmother's bank account because I figured she's dead. She doesn't need the money and I don't want to pay taxes. And I did that stone cold sober, right? Like this, I can't blame my behaviors on blackouts. My behaviors are purely because of I want what I want, what I want, and I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. And I'm now doing things that, I mean, the bottom line is the last few years of my drinking, I was raised to do things. I was doing things I was not raised to do and hanging out with people I was not raised to hang out with. And, you know, we share in a general way. I'll leave it at that. We all have our own little stories. But one of them is that, you know, I emptied my grandmother's bank account. And then I drank before I went to the funeral and volunteered to give her eulogy when I was not asked to. And I called her an ass. How do you make that right? You don't. And I've talked to my sponsor about this and some other things. And he's like, you know what? There's just some things you got to eat. And I'm okay with it today. I mean, I'm not happy about it, but there's nothing I can do to make that right. It was 10 years late, more than 10 years later. I was 10 years sober. My other grandmother died. You know, my parents don't forget stuff, right? They just don't forget stuff. And the harm I caused has been deep. You know, I'm 10 years sober and this is 15 years after that incident. My other grandmother dies and we're at the funeral. My father goes down the line of the grandchildren, you know, Dory, do you want to say anything? Michael, do you want to say anything? Jason, do you? Okay. And then just completely skips me. You know, I'm 10 years sober and they still don't want me saying anything at a funeral. I was 14 years sober before my mother showed me where she kept, you know, the jewelry and stuff, important items, you know, where she kept that stuff in case something happened. 14 years sober because she doesn't trust me. And that's the harm I've caused my family, you know. And I don't know if I get, I guess it's jealousy. I get jealous of like newcomers. They're like 6 months sober and they're so happy. And they're talking about how their relationships with their family are mended. And now they're the executor of the estates of their parents and blah, blah, blah. And I get pissed off. I'm 24 years sober. I'm an attorney. My parents won't make me the executor of their estate. You know, my brother is. That's how much my parents trust me based upon the harm done. You know, I was not somebody, a nice guy who drank too much. I'm a taker who drinks or used to drink. And in any event, to fast forward, I would come in and out of alcohol. I never really came in. I would come and visit Alcoholics Anonymous and leave within 30 days and not do a damn thing. Because I'm the type of person, I think you're supposed to fix me. I would come and I would still feel the same way. I wouldn't get a sponsor. I wouldn't take a step. I wouldn't pick up this. I wouldn't pick up that. And I wanted a drink. And I would say the last year, my drinking, I mean, I would pray to a God every night. Every night. A God I didn't believe in, but I would pray every night. I had a sponsor say to me once, Matt, for somebody who doesn't believe in God, you sure do pray a lot. But I would pray to this God that I didn't believe in every night to just kill me. And then I would curse this God in the morning when he'd wake me up. I was too chicken to take my own life. But suicide was always on my mind until I drank again. And I would get up in the morning and I would drink some mouthwash to get the shakes off. Because I can't be an alcoholic because I don't drink in the morning. That was my, I would say that. Meanwhile, I'm drinking mouthwash. And I would get the shakes off and I would say, this is the day I'm not going to drink again. And I'm drunk again by 4 or 5 o'clock. And it wasn't that I forgot what happened the night before. It was that I would begin to remember how bad it felt to feel sober. By 4 or 5 o'clock, the knots in my stomach are turning. And it seemed like every single day of that last year or so was grayer than the day before. It was Groundhog Day. There was nothing new. I was turning yellow. I had health problems. Doctor had told me 3 years prior, if I keep drinking the way I was drinking, I'll be dead in a couple of years. I was starting to get a little jaundice. I was 120 some pounds. I was dying and death couldn't come soon enough. And the only thing that I can explain is that a God, loving God that I did not believe in intervened and said enough. And I had the dumb idea. Once I found my car again, because I would lose my car. I had this habit of losing my car. I had this dumb idea to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had nowhere else to go at this point. And thank God I had nowhere else to go. Because if I had somewhere else to go, I would have gone there. And I had this dumb idea to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did. And we alcoholics, we get things back pretty quickly. In my case, I quickly got back my opinions. That's what I got back quickly. And I'm dying of alcoholism and I desperately need your help. This is the sickest, I'm about to tell you the sickest thing I've ever done. I'm dying of alcoholism. I have no idea what it is, right? I think I know what alcoholism is. I'm dying of this thing. I desperately need your help, but I'm going to tell you how to help me. And I would come to AA expecting that you're going to fix me. Expecting that the room needs to cater to me. And I began to interview people to sponsor me because I need somebody of a high enough caliber quality to sponsor a guy like me. I'm the guy who asks, you know, the newcomer who asks why. I'm the one who comes in late and makes sure everybody sees me. I'm that guy. And I remember I was told, go pick this guy up. You know, for me, that's not on my way. What does this have to, I have real problems. I need a job and a woman here. What is going to get drive, pick up this guy going to help me with, go clean the ashtrays. Well, I didn't use that ashtray. what does that have to do with my problems? What does this have to do with me staying sober? I told you, I don't believe in God. And I was an AA tick. I hated AA. I did not want what you guys had at all. There was just nothing about this that was attractive, yet I was curious. I kept coming back because, like, there was a bunch of people that were sober, right? You said you were sober, and I had no reason to disbelieve you, but you seemed comfortable. I couldn't relate. There was something going on that I kept coming back, and I didn't think I had exactly what you had, but like there was something of interest that made me keep coming back, and I would come back every day, and I would bitch and complain and whine about Alcoholics Anonymous every day. I mean, I was that guy who basically would say, hey, he's a cult, this is effed up, and blah, blah, blah. And people would tell me, Matt, go drink and come back when you're done. And there was one time that they passed the basket a second time and gave me the money and said, go drink. And I was like, you can't talk to me that way. And I'm sure I stayed sober on a resentment for the next week or two. That is how I was in early sobriety. And really, what I think I was doing, I was looking for option C, right? I was looking for option C. I understood the powerlessness. Like, I understood when they told me to go drink again, I knew I couldn't drink safely. Like, I had proven that to myself. I was convinced that I was powerless over alcohol, right? And that wasn't hard because every time I took a drink, and this is what makes me alcoholic. Like, anytime I take a drink, I cannot predict with any certainty what is going to happen. Period. It might actually be good. I mean, I've been in, you know, treatment centers and whatever, rehabs or newcomers. I'm not going to drink again because I know exactly what'll happen to me. No, you don't. I actually might have a glass of wine now and go to bed. And that's the more dangerous part, because then I'll think I'm fine. I'm no longer alcoholic. I have no idea. Or I might have that same glass of wine and I may be divorcing my wife, or she'll be divorcing me in 2 days when I go, you know, go downtown and go do some things I'm not supposed to be doing. If I have a cup of coffee now, I can predict with certainty what's going to happen. I'm going to get a little jittery, a little wired, and I'm going to pee, right? That's it. And I'm only going to have that one cup of coffee. If I have one drink of alcohol, one sip of alcohol right now, even if it's in my food, you know, because it's, you know, I've suddenly become a foodie or something. I have no idea what's going to happen. My body reacts differently to alcohol. And I understood that. I understood if I take a drink, I don't know when I'm going to stop. And I understood that every time I'm stopped for a period of time, I always start again. Because here's the thing. Every time I went back to drinking, when I decided to go back to drinking, every time I did that, guess what? I was sober right before that. Every time I took a drink, I had been sober. And the book, Big Book, says the problem for the alcoholic center is in his mind. And I kind of got that because I know I've got some issues here. And I understood that powerless, but I couldn't understand why I'm so feeling so miserable, so cold sober. Because I still thought that an alcoholic is somebody who just drinks too much and they stop and they win the lottery. And I hadn't heard it yet. And I'm sitting here in Alcoholics Anonymous looking for an option C. And I'm here to tell you there is no option C. The book gives us two options, right? Drink to the bitter end or accept spiritual help. A or B. And most of the people I leave or work, you know, that I, newcomers that leave Alcoholics Anonymous or that I've worked with, is they're looking for an option C. It's only those two options. And I had a surrender that I can't drink, but I kept looking for this. It's got to be something other than the spiritual help. I mean, I tried to do steps. You know, I did a fourth step, I guess, with this sponsor. I couldn't do the fourth column. I could not find my part. I mean, I read him this fifth step and he said, nice job taking everyone else's inventory. Now go back and take your own. I couldn't do it. I couldn't believe in the guy. I wasn't buying it. It was like half-hearted. It wasn't there. And I struggled with the manageability of this whole thing. Like, I thought I truly believed my life was manageable. Like, and I was completely deluded. I mean, I argued with my sponsor. I said, I have a degree in management. I spent $100,000 on a piece of paper that says, I know how to manage. How can my life be unmanageable? Here's the craziest thing about this. I was 4 years sober before I realized I was one credit short of graduating. I thought I had graduated and all was cool until I went applied to law school and I was missing a credit. That's the delusion I'm running under, that I think my life is manageable because I think I have a piece of paper, which really is not it, which is really invalid. And I thought I was doing fine. I can't be an alcoholic because of this. I can't be an alcoholic because I'm too smart. I can't be an alcoholic because I came from a different religion. I can't be an alcoholic because I have these emotional problems. I can't be an alcoholic because I have other issues. I can't be an alcoholic because I'm definitely better looking than everybody else. Whatever it is, I can't be an alcoholic because I suffered from terminal uniqueness. And one day my sponsor just yelled at me and said, Matt, you're nothing but another garden variety drunk. And I was about 6 months sober. And that was like a chink in the armor, right? Like, and I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, you're just an alcoholic. And I heard it a little bit that day. And then for some stupid reason, I found myself at an AA conference like 2 weeks later. And I heard, the man who would become my sponsor a couple of years later and his sponsor talk, and they talked about alcoholism. And I heard it for the first time. I heard somebody for the first time talk about alcohol. For an alcoholic, alcohol is the solution. And I was like, I thought I was the only one that thought that. Like, I thought I was the only one that thought that alcohol was a solution for me. And these guys at that time, you know, 40 years of sobriety, they're talking about it. And I began to believe I was alcoholic and I surrendered. And I'll tell you what, when I surrendered, the steps got really, really easy, right? I stopped asking questions. I stopped picking and choosing. You know, I kind of think it's akin to like, if I'm out in the ocean treading water, right? I don't know how long I can tread water for, but my deluded mind says I've got, you know, 30 minutes to tread water before I drown, right? Like, I have no idea when I'm going to take my next drink. That's how powerless I am. I don't know when my legs are going to give out and I'm not going to be able to tread water anymore. And it's the same thing with taking a drink. I don't know when that last day is. And people are throwing me life preservers in that water. And I'm going, I don't like a red preserver. Can you go back and get me a blue life preserver? Why do I need that? I'm asking questions, but I'll tell you what, the moment I admitted to my innermost self, I was alcoholic. If I really believe I'm going to drown, I don't care what the life preserver looks like. I'm going to take it. And the moment I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic, I didn't care who gave me the help. I didn't care what the suggestion was. I just did it. The moment I believed I was going to die from this thing, I just did it. And the steps got really easy. Like, it became like gravity. Like, I was like, I don't like this God thing, but I was willing. Like, I was like, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. And that was enough. Like, seriously, that was enough for me. I became open-minded at that point. I became willing at that point. I was willing to get on my knees and say a third step prayer. Because prior to that, I was debating it and making fun of it. And suddenly, magically, in the fourth step, I was able to see my part in things. Not fully and completely, but I was able to see a little bit that I maybe stepped on some of my fellow's toes, and that's why they retaliated. Not that they were intentionally trying to screw me. Not that I was a victim. All that victimness I had began to go away, and I began to realize that I was the common denominator in all of this, that I had signed up and volunteered for all of this. And I began to make amends. And again, it wasn't, it's not a slow learner thing. I just an idiot, I guess. I'm so imperfect. I mean, my sponsor sent me to go make amends to my parents, and I go to fly to Florida, and I get in the car, and I'm trying to make amends to my mother. My mother's informing me that I'm making the amends wrong. I think she had been to AA once or twice. She's informing me, and I told her to go F herself, right? And called her F and B. This is me, like 9 months sober, right? And I hadn't changed. And I obviously had to go back and make amends for the amends at later on. But that's who I am at my core, running around. And but what began to happen is I began to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why. I didn't plan that. I was like, I had this plan, like, I'll get a year and I'll go on my merry way. And maybe I'll be one of these people who show up once a year to pick up my chip and show you how great I'm doing. I don't know. I just had some like vision like that. Let me get mine and I'm out of here. There's nothing to get. I've come to find out there's nothing to get here. It's only to give. I mean, if you're a day sober, you've gotten all you're going to get here. There's nothing else. And I began like taking meetings into treatment centers and I began to sleep at night. Like everything an alcoholic, everything I've gotten everything that I was looking for in alcohol from Alcoholics Anonymous. I just really, and I didn't know this at the time, all I really wanted was to be able to sleep at night. That's all I really wanted, was to be able to sleep at night and shut that crap off and not worry, just not worry all the time. And it happened, and it started happening for me at about 10 months sober. And ironically, that was about the time I started sponsoring my first person. And because what I'm giving to somebody else, and it, I'm more concerned about them and what they're getting than what I'm getting. Because really what keeps me up at night is what I'm not getting or who's going to take something away from me. That's what keeps me up at night. Who took something away from me or who's going to take something away from me or what I'm not going to get. And if I'm spending my days helping you get yours, then I'm too busy worrying about me not getting mine. And the light bulb went off for me. And I don't know, I think I was like 2 years sober and I accidentally said the word God. I accidentally believed that there was a God. I didn't plan that. I was like, you know, because once I, you know, I was, well, I'll be one of these atheist old timers, and not my plan. And this is my experience. It's my opinion, but it's my experience. I don't know how you can thoroughly work our first 11 steps and not believe that there's something bigger out here going on. I don't know how it's possible for me. It's not possible for me. I can't explain how I'm sitting in the basement of a house I half own in Rockville, Maryland, and sharing a Friday evening with you guys in Texas, and we're all sober. I can't explain that. I can't explain how I got from where I was the day before I stopped drinking to where I sit today. I can't explain the events that have transpired. I can't explain that. I give that to God. I can't explain that out of one window out of my office, right? I can see the bar where I used to bartend. Out of another window, I can see the bar where I went to. Well, it's closed. They're both closed. But where it was, of where I took that tequila shot and blew my parents off for my graduation. And then I look out another window and I could see where I had my last drink. And then I look out another window and I could see where I went to my first AA meeting. I can't explain that. And I've moved several times in sobriety since, you know, since that day to now. There's something working in my life. I don't believe it's this punishing God. I don't believe it's a rewarding God. God is not getting me parking spots, right? God is not keeping me safe. Maybe he is, maybe he's not. He is giving me you and the tools to be a useful, productive member of society. And I began to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I told Kristen I was going to end at 9:40, and I will. I fell in love, and I became, you know, this rigid AA-er. Do you know what I'm saying? And like, there's only one way to do AA. And I felt, you know, became very passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been a GSR in four different states. I was DCM chair of our local intergroup, and you know, got active in different levels of service, and all that's great. But I love working with new people more. I don't know. I've had a sponsor pass away. My current sponsor, he's getting up there, you know, and things have happened in sobriety. It hasn't been all roses, you know. It's called life, and Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the tools to deal with that. I'm going to share two quick stories and then I'll wrap up. Maybe I'll share three. I don't know. Where I was going with this, like, you know, I remember I was a GSR when they were printing the fourth edition of the big book, and there was a whole big debate about, you know, because online meetings were coming out. This was in, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, and AOL meetings. And I was like, that's BS. Online meetings are absolute BS. Because there was, you know, in the forward to the, it originally said, to the fourth edition, originally said something to the fact that there was no difference between an online meeting and the home group down the street. And I was like, that's BS and this and that. And there were GSR media and they changed it. And I'll tell you what, I think the pandemic or fatherhood or something has softened me a little bit. Thank God for online meetings. Thank God I get to participate. I used to be very black and white. Yes, this is the only way you can do AA. This is how it has to be done. I used to look at the traditions as punishments and true rules, right? Rather than shared experiences. I was a beneficiary of the pandemic. I mean, I think the pandemic changed me. I mean, I had one kid was born during the pandemic. At the time, I had an 18-month-old. Like, I learned how to work from home and was able to be with my kids. Like, I didn't have to spend money on dry cleaning. Like, I like that. I don't like people, right? I was so excited, like the first, I don't know, 2 years of the pandemic. But after a while, I started missing you guys because that's the problem. I'm an isolator. I'm a loner. I don't like people, but I desperately need people, right? That's how I am. I walk into a room going, nobody better talk to me. And then I go into the room and no one's talking to me. I'm like, why is no one talking to me? But I think some experiences over the pandemic and just kids and different things have softened me, particularly, you know, I was, the day my wife found out she was pregnant with our second, I'd gotten some testing done and I got a call from my doc. It's not good when your doctor calls you. And it turns out I had a heart condition that I did not know about. It was a kind of serious, I guess. And he's like, unless we do something, you've got like 5 years, maybe 5 years before you have a big one. And I don't remember. And like earlier that day, my wife found out, I mean, I got, at that time I had a year and a half old and I have my wife just found out she's pregnant. I'm like, oh shit, multiple times. And it kind of rocked me. And I need to back up, you know, so, and then he wants to have this conversation and, you know, we had to have a talk. And I had a sponsor who passed away about 15 years ago. And he would always say to me, we're living on borrowed time. And I would be, and I mean, I wouldn't outwardly disagree with him. I would disagree with my head. I'd be like, yeah, I stopped drinking when I was like 23, 24, you know, whatever, you know, and I knew he had liver disease. He had all kinds of stuff. So I'm like, I get it. You're on borrowed time, but I stopped well early of that. And yeah. I wasn't that bad, blah, blah, blah. There, the terminal uniqueness again, but he would say it and I would go, oh yeah, we're on borrowed time. And I just never really got it. And so I got that bad news from the doctor and then I had to go see him. And I was just baffled. How the hell do I have this heart condition? And I would sit there like, very straight. I'm like, I haven't done any cocaine in like 20 some years. What, like, and I haven't smoked in like 15. I don't, he's like, Matt, you can't live the way you lived and not have consequences. You've been living on borrowed time. And I was like, oh shit. And I finally got it that we don't know what that is, but we're all living on some sort of borrowed time. And in the meantime, we're here to be of service to other people. And we don't know how our being here is going to affect, because I think, well, I'm here tonight to speak for Kristen and I'm being of service there and this is how I'm going to help. The reality is I don't know what God needs me to do. For all I know, I'm here right now online to give my wife upstairs some peace and quiet. I don't know how I'm really meant to be of service. And that's not for me to decide. My job is just to do what I'm supposed to do and leave the results to God. And I'll share this last story. So, you know, I'm it's about 6 months ago, actually last October, I'm down in Florida. My in-laws live in Florida and there was a big family weekend. There was a bunch of stuff going on. My father-in-law's 80th, niece's bat mitzvah. There was just a whole bunch of things. And it was just a lot of family stuff. I'll say it with a lot of family stuff. And it was chaotic. And at that point I've got, you know, a 3-year-old, 3.5-year-old and a 10-month-old, you know, so my hands are full and I'm getting more irritated by the day, just irritated by the day. And father-in-law's best friend, you know, Friday night, you know, comes pulling on my jacket. Can I talk to you? Well, not now. I got to go chase the kids. You know what I'm saying? Like, and I'm blowing him off. He was wanting to talk to me every day for like 3 days and I'm kind of blowing him off. And I'm just getting in a worse and worse mood. I think by Sunday I decided I was quitting my job too. You know what I'm saying? Like I didn't talk to anybody. I decided like I've already written the resignation letter in my head. I'm just in a, so anyway, I get cornered Sunday morning and he informs me that he's now been sober 1.5 years and he decided to get sober because he had been watching me. I never said a word to him about this. He just knew I was an Alcoholics Anonymous and he knew I was sober and he knew that when there would be family dinners, I would eat my dinner, quietly excuse myself and go somewhere and go be with you. And I guess when he had a problem, he knew where to go. And I don't have to be, you know, driving it down. I learned that I don't have to be, you know, shoving it down someone's throat, that I just need to be an example. And he had been watching me for the last 5 to 10 years. And I had no idea. I always think I got to, you know, be on for this person or that person. And I guess the moral of the story is I never know who's watching. And my sponsor talks about actions or speak louder than words. And he just had been watching that, noticed that I would disappear. You know, after dinner, I would leave and go to these some sort of meeting and I would come back in a better mood. And he became curious what it was that was giving me that better mood. And he knew I didn't drink and he was curious how I didn't drink. And he asked my father-in-law and I don't know. And we talked and, you know, that gratitude lasts like 5 seconds because then he started talking about AA and I'm like, that's wrong. That's wrong. He started, that's wrong. He, you know, and anyway, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. Everything good and decent in my life is the result of direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has taken a child, a selfish brat, and made him a little bit better, and made allowed him to be able to serve you guys and to be a part of your life. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to sleep at night, and that's it. I'm going to go to sleep at night, not worrying about a mistake I made earlier today and not worried about how somebody's going to screw me tomorrow. I'm going to go to bed tonight grateful for the life I have. Thank you for my sobriety. It's exactly 1 hour. Thank you.